are you expecting?
Mark Manderson is author of The Recovery Way, a book that chronicles his personal journey through addiction and recovery. Mark's expertise comes from lived experience with substance abuse and the recovery process. Mark, can we begin with your story? What were the events that led you to where you find yourself today?
Okay, you got it. Well, I'm coming up personally on 23 years of working in the mental health and addiction field. When people ask how I got started, so I got introduced to actually drugs when I was 8 years old, but it's not the typical story. So my aunt was addicted to quite a few things. Heroin, they called it goofballs back then, pills, different things. And she was the fun, outspoken, the kid at heart that all us kids loved. And so what ended up happening was, is she got kicked out of a rehab. And my mom, single mom, with my sister and me, my sister's 22 months younger than me. So I had bunk beds in my room. So Aunt Steffi got to stay with me, which was so much fun. And I just remember one day walking in and she was lying on the floor and just kind of taking a nap, seemed lifeless. When I walked in, there were pills everywhere. And so as an 8-year-old boy walking in, not really understanding what was going on, but just kind of intuitively knew something was wrong. Yeah. I remember trying to wake her and she wasn't responding. So I ran and grabbed my mom. My mom came in and fortunately revived her. Yeah. But because she'd brought drugs into the house, my mom said, you know, I've got two kids. I love you, sis, but I can't have you putting my kids at risk. Yeah. And then so I ended up asking her to leave. And then a few months later, same thing happened, but there was nobody there to save her. So she died of an overdose. Well, I suppressed that memory unbeknownst to me for the majority of my life. Yeah. And went through school and started finding other ways to what I call purge the pain and release the rage. And inevitably came back to this place of just wanting to help people who were suffering. And so started a sober living home and then eventually became a full-blown mental health and addiction treatment center for detox and residential, which is basically full immersion 24/7 care with doctors and nurses and psychologists and therapists. Yeah. And then we started doing outpatient, helping people bridge. And then, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, started doing online education. And I've just kind of done the entire gambit. And it really all started because that little 8-year-old boy walked in and saying, I don't like how I feel. Yeah. It kind of destroyed our family for a while. I don't want any family to go through this because it's actually 100% avoidable once you have the tools and resources and education.
That must have been, and I know, like, I mean, we're probably roughly the same age. Back in those days, there was nothing available to really bring anyone back from having experienced those kinds of traumas. And I think in the last 10, 12 years, we've realized how prolific this is, how far reaching, how many people have had to grow up with these experiences. So what was happening in that moment for you? What happened to you and where did it lead you that led you down the path to eventually turn around and go, what was your darkest moment that created the turnaround for you?
Well, the beautiful thing, the way the brain works is it went into protection mode. So it became a suppressed memory that I wasn't even aware of. And so at a young age, it was just, if you just kind of stuff it, it works. And it did for a while, actually all through high school and college, it was my coping mechanism of just stuff it, put the mask on. Everybody wants to see the good boy that's happy and having fun in this world. And I wore that mask very well. Yeah. And then eventually, I don't know how to explain it other than it's like there was no place left to stuff. And then all of a sudden, everything just erupted.
Yeah.
And when everything erupted, I wasn't able to see a viable future. I went from hopeful to hopeless. Right. And I actually didn't want to live anymore. Uh-huh. So I walked out one day with the intent to end my life. And the reason why I say it that way is it wasn't that I wanted to die. It's just I didn't want to live how I was. But I didn't see any other option. And so fortunately, one of the therapists, and I've had a lot of coaches and mentors and guides throughout my life. I had one in particular that was able to to kind of turn something around from a perspective I'd never seen before because I was so ashamed. I'm Christian, and so our belief is you don't do it. It's like one of the big no-nos. You don't take your own life. There's actually eternal consequences, and so I was trying to find creative ways to do it. And I couldn't think of a way where it looked like an accident. And so I hid that for such a long time of the guilt and shame of going, I suck so much at life. I can't even find a way to end it. And so I had someone that stepped in and said, gosh, I'm so glad you're a failure in life. And that was no one had ever done that before. Everybody else had coddled me and kind of been like, oh, that must be so tough, which I didn't know, kind of continued to keep me in that victim mindset. And when this a-hole had the audacity to say that, I'm like, what do you mean? And he goes, well, you failed at probably the easiest thing to do in life. He goes, don't you think there's a part of you that said there's a reason why you're still alive? And that was the aha moment where I kind of went, I never thought of it that way. I thought this was something that was happening to me, not that there was a part of me that I wasn't aware of that was fighting and continually taking control, going, no, we're not done yet. And once I started doing the work to give that voice the driver's seat, that is what started to open my world to say, this isn't about me anymore. I got to heal for me. But if I can figure this out, I think I can help a lot of people because from seeing an overdose as a kid of actually going out with the intent to take my own life, these are two things that so many people deal with. I mean, I just saw something the other day, at least here in the States, it's the number one killer of men under 45 is suicide. And the part is all the pain I felt was self-inflicted. I didn't understand it at the time, at the moment, but it was self-inflicted by the stories, the beliefs, the narrative. And so as I started to unpack that, my parents were brilliant. They put me in therapy. At six, when they ended up getting divorced, and I didn't know you could stop, so I'm still going to therapy. I've just gone to different therapists, and now it's just a wonderful tool of learning new perspectives, new modalities to continue for my journey, but also that I'm able to share with the world and to do what it is that I do here, helping people with mental health and addiction
Yeah, it's
issues.
our responsibility to pay it forward 100% of the time. So you touched on something earlier where you said shame. You were talking about the feeling of shame. In your opinion, what is, there's lots of theories about why people become addicted, and one of them is lack of connection. But when you said shame, it really also turned an aha moment for me instantly. Was what is, in your opinion, is the relationship between shame and addiction?
I think there's a huge part that the two tools that we educate our clients on is I call it tools of the devil, evil, darkness, whatever you want to call it, but is guilt and shame. And when we live in this place of taking on the guilt and the shame, because they're lies, but they feel so real and they keep us isolated. So that was one of the other things is I have a wonderful family, I have a ton of friends. But because I didn't know how to cope, I felt completely alone, even in a room with people that cared about me. And so loneliness is different than being alone. Isolation is more of an unconscious choice. And so as we start to get more educated on that, what I say is shared pain is shared, or when you share your pain, you divide the pain that you feel. And so as we start to open up, all of a sudden it's not our burden to carry because we think we're broken. That guilt and the shame says, oh, it's only me. Out of the, what, 8-point-something billion people in this world right now, I'm the only one that's this messed up. Nobody will understand. And so don't share, don't talk, because then you're really going to get judged and persecuted. And that was what the war within up here, I call it the weapons of mass instruction. And so as this continued to terrorize me, I finally just, I can't take this anymore. And when I started to share, the people that were honest said, me too. The ones that weren't would say what I feared of like, oh, you know, whatever, there's always going to be finger pointers in this world. But eventually those finger pointers eventually would say, I've seen you change. I'm kind of dealing with some similar stuff and I'm not really sure what to do. And it's like, whoa. I was so concerned about how you used to view me, and by me just continuing the path that's been put before me, I was able to model to you of going from the pit of pain to the peak of prosperity and purpose and passion. And you've seen this journey. Now you're wanting the why? So how much wasted time we give of the illusion of people are going to judge us, and what if they do? Meanwhile, they're having the same insecurities. What if this person judges me?
I mean, I wrote my story and published it online and then in my first book, and the number of people who came up to me subsequently and said, "Well, that's my story too," blew my mind. And then I realized the responsibility we have to put it out there. The only person judging us is ourselves, and that's okay. It's okay. But there's so many questions, but I just want to stay here for a bit because where does this come from? I mean, our parents, most people bring up their children in a state of love and kindness and compassion. So where do we learn to think of ourselves as alone and isolated and shameful beings when this is simply not true?
Well, this is the beauty of the way that the human psyche works. And I say beauty because when we're in the thick of it, it doesn't feel beautiful. It feels like just pure crap. But as we understand, this is the way the mind works. So it has nothing to do with me. It's basically the downloaded software that has allowed us to continue to reprocreate again and again and again. So it goes back to survival. If you think about it, I mean, hundreds of thousands of years ago, it was, I have to be part of the tribe and I have to contribute. If I don't, I'm the weak link. And if I get banished, banishment means death. And so the software hasn't caught up with, I mean, there's nothing hunting us. If you get banished from the tribe nowadays, you can go online and find another tribe. It's amazing. But what it is this deep-rooted DNA process that says we must stay a part of the tribe. If we get excommunicated, it is death. It is physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual death. So, whatever it takes, be the person you have to be, wear the mask you have to wear to stay part of a tribe. And that is that internal conflict at the unconscious level. So, that's what we do is we do the work to bring that conscious. So, when it says that, we go, okay, I understand this is a lie. It feels real, but let's go ahead and go through a different process. And I write about the process in my book. But as we go through the process, we go, oh, I don't have to believe every thought I have. I can begin to challenge that and become an observer of my thoughts.
I love that reframe. So in your book, The Recovery Way, you talk about how society's approach to addiction is fundamentally broken and how, the truth about addiction recovery, it's simply, I think there's such a misunderstanding about what addiction really is to begin with. So what prompted you to go and put it out there and publish a book?
So for the first probably 10 to 15 years of doing the work, schooling was always incredibly difficult for me. I was the student that had to sit front row because if I sat a couple rows back, I would look at movement and stare and talk with people. So I had to, it was like those blinders that they have on horses. I had to force that just to learn. And I would go to office hours before and after class as much as possible. So I've always struggled with learning. And again, thought I was alone, thought I was broken. Later find out, oh, most people do. And then especially in our school system, if you're forced to learn about something you don't give a crap about, it's really tough. But on the contrary, if you're learning about something that just fascinates you and you're obsessed with, you can't get enough of it. And so what I found is so many books in addiction are written by brilliant minds. I mean, PhD doctors, neuroscientists. But what I found is, as I'm reading these books, I'm like, I've just read the same page 8 or 9 times, and it's like reading an engineering explanation of how to operate a system that I know nothing about. And so I thought, gosh, I feel so dumb. Let me see if other people. And as I started asking other people, they're going, oh, I didn't even make it past the first page. I don't. I mean, he's brilliant. I watch his podcast, but I don't understand this. And so one of the things I started to do is look at, okay, what seems to work in different modalities. And then bring them in. What I do is I'm my own human guinea pig. So I try it on me first. If it works, I have a small group of individuals I work with. I bring it in. I say, hey, this is really working for me. Let's try it out in here. If it works in here, then I bring it into our center and say, okay, we've got proof of concept. Let's see how it works here. And when it does, that becomes part of our curriculum and what we've been doing for a quarter of a century. So it took a while to get there. And then eventually enough people said, man, this is so simplified. Like the way that it's just broken down into the five foundational freedoms and then the four codes and the three decrees. I mean, there's systems and it's this simple framework that they can plug in whatever season of life they're in. It's not like, here's what you must do verbatim. It's here's the framework. So whatever you want to plug into this framework with the season of life, you take that action, you put it into that framework, and then you get the results. And so I basically, I don't know, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago. Every year at the end of the year, I sit down, I call it communion with my creator. I have my prayer and meditation and say, what is the big thing that you want me to do next year? And back in 21 or 22, it was, you're going to write a book. And I went, oh gosh, I hate it when I hear my voice over God's. Okay. And it was, no, you're going to write a book. I'm thinking, man, my narrative, my internal dialogue is so loud right now. I can't even hear my creator talking to me. And it's kind of like, I'm going to give this to somebody else unless you do it. And I'm going, oh,
Oh no.
okay, it is you.
Okay.
And so I'm not a writer. And so I just sat down and started writing. And some days it was terrible. And other days the pen's flow. Well, actually, I type. So I can't say the pen's flowing, but I'm sitting there typing. I'm reading. I'm like, this is brilliant. I know this isn't coming from me. And at the end of a year, it was this beautiful manuscript that we just kept putting out there and cutting and adding and editing and different things. And now the finished product is what people see. And it's the best compliment I get is when people will either email me or come into our center and say, you know, your book's the first book that I think I've ever read as an adult. I read it from beginning to end. It was like you were in my head when we were having a conversation that was already going on. I had no idea other people thought this way. And I was kind of like, wow, I had no idea it was that powerful. And then we start seeing people apply the actions that are in the book, and their life begins to change. It's a beautiful, beautiful
Oh,
thing.
that is such a blessing to be able to be part of a solution for so many people. So when we think of addiction, we think of drugs, we think alcohol, we think cigarette smoking. What are the addictions? What are the people that come to your facility, to your clinic, and the people you interact with all the time? What are addictions? Because it can be so much more far-reaching than just the typical, drugs, alcohol, and cigarettes.
Yeah, so it's kind of a multifaceted question, so I'll try to answer it in its entirety. So as far as people that come into the center, those typically probably 90 to 95% of the time are alcohol or drugs. Those are the big ones. And then as we start doing the core work there, that's where we start seeing some of the process addictions that have come up and surfaced. But I define addiction as any behavior that has a negative consequence on your life, and the instant you do it, you have this feeling of regret right away. And so that's where, I mean, fortunately and unfortunately, more people are talking about it. So the goal is to remove the stigma less and less. But there's still a lot of judgment. Like we just had a person come in who it was only marijuana. And I say only marijuana because so many people are like, well, that's not a real drug, that's natural. And it's kind of like, well, everybody has opinions, but let me ask you this. Is it negatively affecting your life? You want to stop, you say you will, and then you find yourself engaging in the behavior that you just felt ashamed of doing before, and you can't stop. So regardless of what the drug of choice is, what the trigger or stimulus is, if it meets that criteria, that's where we want to pull back the sheets and say, well, let's take a look at what is the feeling you're attempting to get from engaging in that action. What are you trying to numb and sedate, or what are you trying to gain or to feel? And so that is where now we go outside of our center. And I mean, a lot of people online, just in talking, we'll see, well, I'm addicted to codependent relationships. I'm desperate for a person to tell me what I've been needing to hear this entire time because my mom or my dad didn't tell me. It's kind of like, oh, sorry to hear that. Great news is we can help you through that, even though there's no drugs or alcohol that are part of the process. But it's, again, anytime that I'm continually doing something that I say I don't want to do, and then the moment I do it, there's that regret.
Yeah, that is so interesting because it's almost like drugs and alcohol are an object that we become addicted to. But when we're addicted to people's opinions about ourselves and feeling good because somebody tells you you're doing well, we don't think of that in terms of an addiction. And it really is. I mean, now that you've said that, it's that's quite profound.
Yeah, as human beings, and I don't want to oversaturate it, but as human beings, we're all addicted to something. So addiction isn't necessarily a bad thing. Some of the most successful, fulfilled individuals I know overcame their physical addictions and learned how to focus it into purpose. So one of the things that we teach here is you find your purpose within the pain. So the pain actually provides the purpose. If I feel the pain and I continue to sedate, I haven't met a person that's been able to find their purpose through continual sedation of the pain, but only learn to sit in the pain. And again, the irrational fear, going back to the 100,000-year-old part of the brain, it says, this is scary, I'm going to die. It's kind of like, no. Nobody's ever died from emotion. It feels like it at times. I mean, I've had broken hearts before, and it feels like I'm going to die, but I have not died yet from a broken heart. So as we start to understand this, when we learn to sit in the pain, and then we have some modalities here, we take clients through of actually talking to that part of them, finding out what is the pain wanting them to know, what is the lesson, what is the unmet need. And what's incredible is as they break through that perceived fear, it's irrational, but it feels rational. On the other side is the peace they've been looking for the entire time. And as we continue to expose these core lies, our clients learn how to create a life they no longer want to sedate or even retire from. Because when you align purpose with passion, and then that becomes this new North Star, that's what I mean by addiction actually is a beautiful thing once learning to have a healthy relationship with it. Because now I'm not the person in the back seat and my addiction's the driver. The addiction is in the passenger seat. So there's times where I go, I don't feel like doing this right now. Hey, addict self, can you kind of help me out? You got it. We're going to run through walls. I'm going to help you get this. Thank you for giving me the direction that was needed, if that makes
That makes
sense.
a lot of sense. So, I mean, a lot of I've read a couple of books about, addiction, and I'm not sure I can't remember the guy who wrote this book. It was an ultra trail runner, passed away a couple of years ago, and he started off with an alcohol and drug addiction and transferred that addiction to ultra trail running. And we see this a lot with extreme athletes. Is transference of addiction a healthy thing, an unhealthy thing? And I suppose you're going to say, do we feel regret after transferring that addiction? Or is it serving our lives, or is it not serving our lives? Do you see a lot of people who come through your facility transfer their addiction? So they were addicted to marijuana and now they're addicted to running. How often do you see that transference happen?
That's such a good question. I'm glad you bring that up because the regret part is in the initial phase, but we see this all the time. So the second question that I would ask is, are you engaging this behavior to avoid something, to avoid feeling something? Because we find that quite often. We're in Orange County, California, where it's sunny 355 days a year. Most people walk around with their shirt off or their bikini tops on. And so a lot of people will go, okay, I'm no longer using. So I'm going to work out 2, 3 hours a day. I'm going to count every single micronutrient and macronutrient, which if you look at from a societal level, it's kind of like, oh, that's healthy. Go for it. But again, what is the intent behind it? Are you doing it to avoid sitting in the pain? Because again, once we sit in the pain, we intuitively know, like our souls are so brilliant at knowing what we need. The problem is we've become so disconnected from actually creating the space and solitude to have that communion time within ourselves. Because that part goes, you know what? I'm a little tired today. And so working out might not be the best for us. Let's take a break and just sit in this emotion. And then that's where you can see some people go, oh, I gotta do 3 trail runs today because now I'm really feeling it. That's where we would look at to say, what are you running from?
I do that. If I don't want to face something, I get on the treadmill until it hurts. And then I was like, okay, now you've got to just wake up and deal with what you're avoiding. I think it's at least, being aware of that is where the healthy behavior starts to come in, is knowing that you're just knowing that you're running away from something. That's a good start.
So the first step is awareness and just having that internal dialogue. Is this running because I'm going to enjoy it and it will fulfill me and bring the beauty that I'm searching for in life today? Or is it I don't know how to deal with this, or I feel negative or down or depressed or anxious, so this is now a new coping mechanism. And then that's where you want to kind of
There's
look.
your clue. So your work really does emphasize that recovery needs more than just stopping behavior, because you can't stop. Behavior serves us. All behavior has a positive intention. It doesn't always have a positive outcome. But it also means building a new life. So if you could give someone who is aware of the fact that they need help, one concrete habit or something they could start doing immediately that would really strengthen their resolve, what would it be?
So if I'll rewind to the first part of the question that you asked, because again, it's another great question. A lot of the time someone will stop the behavior and then wonder why they pick it back up just a day or a week or even a month later. So one thing that I've learned over time is the brain doesn't know how to not do things. So It's fine. This is way back in the day, but I used to get flown out to New York for Fashion Week. I did a little bit of modeling back in the day, and I remember you would hear some of these girls getting ready. Oh my gosh! Okay, don't trip, don't trip, don't trip. And what's interesting is the very few that would say that out loud, no joke, they would trip on the runway. And it was so intriguing because the ones that didn't trip weren't telling themselves don't trip. So the way the brain does it is, oh, I don't understand not to do something. So, I mean, this, I'll give you a quick example. This one always makes me laugh. It's not mine. It's been heavily used. But if you close your eyes, I'm going to tell you not to think of a pink elephant. Don't think of a pink elephant. First thing the brain does is it removes the knot and goes, oh, pink elephant, poop, and it pops up. So if I try to not do something, the brain doesn't understand. So that's the first step, is to not focus on what you don't want, because you continue to attract that, as weird as it sounds. The second part, they call it the replacement method. So it's, what do you want instead? So if it's something of, here's the behavior. I don't want to run, whatever it is. Okay, what do I want to do? What is a healthy replacement I can go ahead and put in that place? Because the brain works on loops. Like if I sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, How I Wonder,
You will finish
and
the song.
stop, the brain always goes, I need closure. And that's one of the codes in the book, is closure. But the brain works that way. So if I have open loops, the brain automatically will start closing it with things that may not be the best. So by providing that closure, ending that loop, that helps the brain say, this has been resolved. Now we can move on to the next thing. So that was the first part of your question. The second part is that's where we came up with what I call first fruits, or the five to thrive. Remember, every time I get on a flight, they say, listen, we expect beautiful, calm skies, but if it gets a little crazy and the oxygen comes down, Mister, I see you travel with a lot of people. Make sure all the kids have the air on first. Make sure your grandparents are taken care of. And then once you've tended to everybody else, then put the oxygen. I already see you nodding no. No, they don't say that. They say, make sure you've got the oxygen first, then go ahead and help the kids, which is kind of counterintuitive. The reason why is because if you don't, you die from asphyxiation before you can help anybody. We don't understand this concept for some reason in our own lives. So that's why first fruit, the first hour of every single day, that is me time. And that's where I go over the five foundational freedoms. So I do some work in the fitness realm. I do some work in the faith realm, family and friends, finances, and feelings. And that first hour, when I do my own self-inflection, I do my own work. Now the other 23, I'm set up to serve, and I am resonating at such a high frequency that life A is so much more enjoyable, but I'm able to be used in ways that I wasn't able to be used before. So those are the five to thrive and the perfect 10. There's two specific action items across each of those foundations that as you do the work, and it's scalable. So it's like if you're a white belt, you're not going to be doing this black belt crazy stuff. You just do small, tiny actions. And then over time, you progress till eventually you're at black belt status. You're doing crazy, awesome stuff that works so well, so effective. So you're able to go on. And that's all in the book as well, The Recovery Way.
How long did it take you to establish those morning rituals? Because it is tough to be consistent. And a lot of people, myself included, we judge ourselves when we don't get it right all the time. How do you work at being so consistent?
So the first part, and this is the part that I did not think that consistency was a superpower, and actually had a group of men. I did a keynote speech in Vegas, I think it was last year, the year before, called The Simplicity of Consistency. So just from the language that you shared of, it's so tough, the brain goes, oh, I just got a direction, an order. This is going to have to be tough, so we're going to make it tough. On the flip side, so this is the part. We're going to get to the part first that will actually kind of stoke the shame, and then we're going to get to the shame. So stick with me. First part is it's not difficult. When we tell ourselves it's difficult, the brain has no other choice than to make it difficult. So when I look at it and say, okay, well, for fitness wise, here's what most people do. Okay, I'm going to get a gym membership. I'm going to hire a trainer. I'm going to work out 3 hours a day. I'm going to do, it's like, whoa, hold on. You're going black belt. We got to teach you white belt. And so in the beginning, it might be something as, okay, can you do 10 push-ups?
I like
No,
that.
that's a lot. Not a problem. Can you walk the block? Is your block around half a mile to a mile? Oh, okay. And then the second BS belief systems. The second BS is, well, I don't have the time. Well, so does everybody else, did they find a magic 25th hour in the day? Or is it just, I'm not being accountable or intentional to where I'm putting my time? That one stung for me because I thought everybody else had this secret that I didn't know. And if I knew, then I'd be doing fine because now that puts it back the accountability and responsibility on me.
Always.
So that's where this part initially kind of stokes the shame and the guilt, but that's where we want to come and say, you know what? I don't have to do any of this. This does not define me. So the days I do it, I'm going to give myself one of these. I remember in school, they say, put your hand up, turn it over, lean forward. Yeah. I don't know why that stuck out, but I remember that from grade school. You do one of those. The days you don't do it, you say, you know what? That's okay. If I wake up tomorrow, which so far I have a 100% track record,
It's
I get a do-over, I'm going to go ahead and do it tomorrow.
okay.
Now, if there's still time before you're going to bed, and I do this quite often, it's, 8 p.m., 9 p.m., like, oh, I forgot to do this one thing. Well, I'm going to go ahead and do it now. Well, I don't have the time. Then I'm just going to do 10% of it. As I get in the repetitions, I start building the self-trust. Once I have the self-trust, that consistency is what builds the self-trust. Then it just becomes this compounding effect. So a few weeks turns into a few months. You're kind of like, oh, okay, I can see this. Turns into a few years. And now I've been doing this for decades. It's no longer what I do, it's who I am.
It's who
And
you are.
it's this beautiful process. I'm able to connect with myself from the fitness realm. The science behind it is brain chemistry changes. When our brain chemistry changes, we start to feel better. We tend to make better decisions. Now, also, I'm playing this game of longevity. I just don't want quality of life. I want quantity as well as quality. So now I go out and have conversations. Nick, you're going to say, okay, Mark, you've officially lost it. I go out and have conversations with my future self. And I say, okay, what do you need me to do today to take care of you?
Oh, wow.
And there's times where it will be, well, you've been eating a lot of sugar lately, and you've been inflamed, and your back is starting to hurt again. Going, oh, you know what? I have. That's right. I haven't been auditing my life as of this week. Thank you, future self. And then I come back to now, and this is also in the book, but it's auditing my life. When I audit my life, I can make the changes instead of going what we call the BS of New Year's resolutions, and then only one check-in per year. That's why I think I just read the study. I think it's over like 92 or 94% of New Year's resolutions fail within the first 3 weeks. Well, why? Because people don't have a blueprint and a system that they're continually recalibrating.
Just on what you said, for myself, when I'm negotiating with myself on whether to not to exercise in the morning, the reframe I like to use is I don't have to exercise, I get to exercise. And for me, that's been a really powerful reframe as well, is it's something that we should actually step back and realize that it's a privilege to be able to do these things, to journal, to pray, to move, to eat healthy food, to make better choices. It's not a grind if we really think about it. And a lot of what you've said from the beginning is permission to think differently. The reframe is so powerful. And even way back when the first thing, when you were battling, is when someone said to you, think about it differently, and that was your pivotal moment. Is how magical would it be if we could offer each other just simply ways to rethink about how we do life, even if it's like it doesn't have to be true or accurate. And I think a lot of us also hold ourselves back from saying what we think we should be saying to people when we see they're in trouble, but you never know who you're going to touch. And I think it's really, really important to just offer glimmers of hope and the ability to see something through somebody else's eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if we're not able, so here's one of the things that I think I've come to believe so far in my life is that I was looking for someone in my darkest moment to come save me and nobody showed up. But the beauty of that was I became the person that I was desperately seeking and needing. And as I did that work, I'm able to go back and to love that part of me. And that's part of my annual retreat I do is go back to that part of me and actually enjoy that part, letting them know, hey, bud, you're safe. I'm here for you. What do you need? I'm not here to fix you. I'm just here to be with you. I'm jumping in the pit in the pit of the darkness, and we can just hang out. And it's amazing because that's all it wanted, was to feel seen, to feel heard, and it was seeking permission from myself. And so as we allow that pain, we become the person that we've been looking for. And then we can go ahead and share that with other people, rinse, repeat. This world gets a little bit better.
And I mean, also to your point earlier, when you said that our biggest primal fear is being alone, yet that's where our strength is. Yet we cannot do this without other people because, one of our biggest reasons that people are committing suicide is isolation. And I mean, in the last 5 years, this has been a massive social issue. It's always been a social issue, but I think it's really come to the light now, because it's become more prolific. It's an incredible story of I think hope doesn't even touch on what I'm trying to express here. What would be for someone who's listening who is, and I'd like to actually touch on sugar addiction with you, because this is also something that is becoming a major health crisis. And they say that whether it's cocaine or heroin, whether it's sugar, it's all the same thing. Why, in your opinion, why do you think, is it our exposure to, there's nothing else, there's so much cheap processed food around, or is it something else that is creating, I don't want to use the word pandemic, but it really is a pandemic of food addiction, the same pathway. How much of this are you seeing in your facility?
Oh, sure. Well, sugar is one of the most addictive drugs on the market, and it's easily accessible. So I think it's kind of a double-edged sword, because the consequences are far different than if you're addicted to crack cocaine or alcohol or something like that. So there's a lot to be said there. Also, definitely the harder drugs that hit that part of the brain where the dopamine just keeps going like wildfire, that is where, I mean, behavior, all the studies show that animals and humans will literally kill themselves to continue to get that. So there is a difference between sugar addiction and alcohol and cocaine or heroin, different things. But to answer your question is, well, sugar, again, going back to the primal part of the brain, back in the day, it was very limited. So when you would see sugar, your brain craves it because it can convert it to energy very, very quickly. And so when we would, as hunters and gatherers, when you find the honeycomb, you just binge on it because your body goes, yes, I can grab this and then I can store this. And then we can go ahead and take it back some other time because we don't know when we're going to see it again. It was never meant to be accessible 24/7 and in everything you eat, at least here in the Americas. And so a lot of it is ease. And then the other part is even though we know and we're told, oh yeah, sugar's not good for you, it's an inflaming agent and it causes all sorts of health concerns, kind of, oh yeah, when I get older I'll eat less sugar. So it's the progressive part you don't see. And this is still a pretty new part in my journey. Last year is when I made the decision to say, if I am going to live this longevity game, I really need to be aware of what I'm putting in my body and to look at food as a source of fuel and not comfort. That became one of my unconscious sedation tools, is when I had a great day, let's go celebrate with ice cream and different things. If I'm depressed, let's eat ice cream. And next thing I knew, at my worst, I was up to 240 pounds, right around 30% body fat. And so it's only been the last probably year, yeah, right around a year, where as I started becoming more conscious, I did a 16-day cleanse where I just stripped all the sugar out. And what I didn't understand is how tied it is to energy. I mean, my adrenals were just stripped. I was fatigued 24/7, 365. But the lie I told myself was, well, I'm starting to get older. And everybody I talk to says, oh, when you get older, you just start to hurt more. And I thought that was a truth as opposed to people's experience. And so some of the things I found is, A, my taste buds reset, which I didn't know. I've heard that about smokers. Once people stop smoking, they can taste more. I didn't think it would be from cutting out processed food and sugar. So it was incredible of going, I can eat, like, I remember the first salmon I had. I just put it on the grill, nothing on. I ate it, and literally I'm sitting there like, I don't know if you've seen the movie What About Bob, but there's a scene where it's like, I'm sitting there, and my kids and my wife are going, what are you doing over there? I'm like, it tastes like there's butter, and it's just, I mean, it was incredible. My taste buds came back. Next thing is I didn't know this. When you eat food, you've got a baseline. And the way that it works is you get a nice little, it's not a spike, you get this nice little incline of energy, and it lasts about an hour. And then it's not a spike down like sugar, it's a natural decline. And all of a sudden, I'm going, I have so much more energy. And when I eat for about 45 minutes, I'm like, let's go. What do you want to do? And then I come back to my normal energy. Biggest thing for me, I had back surgery years ago. The inflammation completely gone. No more pain when I walk, when I sleep, when I work out. And so looking at this and going, this is all based now for me, it was sugar and dairy. I'm like, I had no idea. So I try not to be the guy that goes around and tells everybody, you got to eat this way and you got to, but it's just kind of like, look, if you have fatigue, if you have inflammation, there's a way, whereas you cut sugar out and dairy out, your body knows what to do and goes back to the natural state that says, not only do you look better, but you feel better. So now I'm the dad that's playing with all the kids while the other dads are sitting on the sidelines, kind of like, oh gosh, I'm winded. Yeah, you must not work. I'm like, no, I just did an 8-hour day and I can't wait for more. Like I'm the obnoxious dad now.
Oh, I love that. I see that in my practice all the time. Doesn't matter how old or young a person is, when they go off sugar for a solid 2 weeks, they all come back and they go, oh my God, I have so much energy. And they haven't been eating the junk, and it's without fail. And most people come to me because they have an energy crisis. And it's absolutely ridiculous how we've engineered a food system and a culture and a way of doing life that sucks the life out of us. But it's reversible. It's reversible. What we've got to hit that pain point. And just a thought, talking about sugar and dietary habits, how important, in your opinion, is the role of family in the recovery process when you're working with, your patients?
Yeah, well, that's why it's one of the five foundational freedoms. It's family and friends. So addiction is isolation. So that means recovery is community. And so what we've found, there's direct correlation. Those that come through the center that have familial support, they thrive. And we actually created a family program that's online self-pay. So when the loved one comes in, their loved one is with us. And then the family, whether it's the husband or wife, the adult children, or the parents, they're going through the online family program for 6 weeks and learning about these different things. So when they come together, they're able to address, we call it compassionate confrontation, no longer walking on eggshells, and how to address the issues that might be uncomfortable to you, but in a healthy way. And so when we're able to confront compassionately, there's no more eggshells. We have those real and raw conversations that lead to a much deeper connection. I mean, intimacy goes up, connection goes up, laughing, experiences, all that. So there's a huge direct correlation.
In my experience, I've come across over the past, I mean, in the couple of years, the 20 odd years that I've been doing this, many couples who enable each other's addiction, food addiction in my case. So, for example, a woman will come to me because she needs to lose weight because she's diabetic, but the husband likes her to look a certain way, so he might like her to be overweight. But there's more to it than that, because she's no not a threat. There's no threat of her leaving. I see this a lot with high net worth people, women specifically, whose husbands are big earners and they're overweight and their health is in danger. And these women have come to me and said, he's worth more to me, like this, because he will leave if he loses weight. Well, I'm afraid that he will leave me if he loses weight. So they get in the way of their spouse's progress and health and long-term happiness. How do you work with those sorts of situations? I find them very, very challenging.
Yeah, I was going to say, good thing they find you to work through that. So one of the sayings, I remember hearing this back in maybe like 2014, 2015, and it resonated with me. And it's specific into relationships. And it's, if you treat the end like it's the beginning, there will never be an end. And so that was so beautiful, because I remember when I was courting my wife, I would drive over an hour to see her. I remember one time she came over, she forgot a retainer. So I drove that hour and then came back because she was still at work and like all these things. And then, once you get settled in, oh man, I forgot this at the grocery store. Well, you better go to the grocery store then. It's kind of like, oh, I'm actually starting to change how I show up and court you. So one of the things is looking at what were the things you did together in the beginning? What did you enjoy doing? And so one of the things we look at is that codependency is if I'm having a relationship like this out of need, it never goes well. But if I learn how to do my own self-work so I can love openly and I can come from a place of, I don't need you, I desire you. It is such a more freeing relationship where I'm in it because I choose to be as opposed to because I need to be.
Or contractually obliged to be, which is such a trap as well. So for someone who's listening and who feels stuck, and I'm sure 9 out of 10 people listening to the show will identify with so many of the themes that we've discussed today, what's the first small step they can take, whether it's to start on a road of recovery or just to start getting real about where they are in life? What would you say is the most important first step?
Yeah, the most important first step first is the awareness. And so once you become aware, and after doing this for just under a quarter of a century and watching different patterns, that's why I came up with the five foundational freedoms. So I actually, if you're okay with it, I put together a free Google document of how to become consistent and how to build out a morning or even an evening routine, but basically a routine that is habitually based, and that becomes the foundation that drives all the healing on the other side. So basically, I mean, if you just find me at my social media on Instagram, it's at Pacific Shores Recovery. And if you just DM me Nikki Habits, I'll know that they heard from this. And so I'll just go ahead and give them access to that little free habitual breakdown. I call it the Habits Blueprint.
Brilliant, brilliant. I would absolutely encourage anyone listening to do that because, I think we all need to start building habits and become a little bit more aware in our lives. The what's the worst that can happen? You just become that much happier and that much more, alive in your life and part of life. So,
Yeah,
wow.
well, all behavior is learned. That's the part that baffled me for the longest time. I thought I was broken. I didn't know. Everything I do has just been learned unconsciously from my earliest memories, whether it was through church, through school, through home. And because it's been learned, that means I can unlearn and then relearn new things for a complete different outcome. So that's why I love looking at the habitual behavior. And then through challenging some of it and putting new habits, all of a sudden you end up on a complete different path.
So, Mark, where can people find your book?
Amazon, probably the easiest. You can go to Amazon. You just search The Recovery Way by Mark Manderson, and it still should hopefully pop up there.
And how we'll put all of your social media contacts in the show notes.
Easiest way is probably just through social media. You can go ahead and just direct message me at Pacific Shores Recovery. If you want more information on our actual full immersion of our brick and mortar treatment center, definitely reach out. We'll get in touch with you. But just here to help. I want to help change as many lives as possible.
I love that. And they can also hear more about you via your podcast.
Yeah, we started last year. We started a podcast, and it's kind of evolved over that. In the beginning, it was just clients who that we would do our like a 3 year check-in, 6 year, 7 year, 10 year. Just found out 20 year check-in for one particular client who has 20 years sober. So what we do works, but we just started having them come on and just share their experience of what life was like before, what they expected coming into treatment, what it was actually like, and what life's like now. And as I think the first like 5 to 10 episodes started getting traction, we started getting people would reach out, little kind of, I'll call them local celebrities that had these stories that say, a lot of people don't know this about me, but I went to prison and I was addicted and now I'm doing this. And so it's just kind of become a place of stories of transformation of how life used to be and then how beautiful and wonderful and fulfilling and joyful life can become when you start applying these types of tools and resources.
That's absolutely wonderful. And may you continue to just send your light out into the world. This is an incredible blessing, and you're doing so much good. So let's get the word out and help more people heal.
I love it. Thank you so much for having me on. It was great getting to meet you.